Hi, everybody. Good evening. Welcome to the Evoke Therapy Program's broadcast. Today is Monday, March 29th, 2021. Tonight is an open forum. So any questions you have about therapy, about Evoke, about parenting, about relationships, I'm happy to take my best shot at. If you have a pre-submitted question, we'll get to that first. If you want to submit live questions throughout, you can submit those at any time. And Malia, who is moderating for me this evening, will pass those on to me when there's time in the broadcast. So I have one pre-submitted question, so I'm going to get to that first, but please submit questions at any time. Let me get to the pre-submitted question. Somebody writes, looking back on my child's early age struggles with mental health, behavior challenges since toddlerhood, I am reflecting on how little help there was, and most of it was token economies and often didn't work and often made things worse. I find myself wishing I'd gotten him the help he is getting now, and then remind myself that help didn't exist at that age, the way it does now through wilderness and residential. Thoughts on early childhood mental health field? You know, more than anything, I have compassion for you because I think, well, there's two thoughts that I have. I think we're always learning and always evolving, and I imagine that even in my own process, I'll become more aware, more conscious, more insightful as I grow older. But there's another piece of it that I don't know that we would have known what to look for, because most of us came into parenting with one simple idea, which is, well, I guess it's a few simple ideas, but a simple idea about parenting, which is I'm going to love my children. I'm going to not make the mistakes that my parents made. And then I'm going to tell my children, this is the most insidious one that most of us came into parenting with, which is I'm going to tell my child how I feel so that they'll know whether or not they're on track, they're doing the right thing or doing the wrong thing. And that third piece of most of our inclinations coming into parenting, that becomes the biggest problem. The second piece about not doing it worse than your parents or not making the same mistakes of your parents is what I found, which I'm sure all of you have found, is that we'll just find a way to make new mistakes, or perhaps even worse than that, we'll compensate for our parents' mistake by erring on the other side of the equation, right? We'll swing the pendulum too far to the other side of things, and we'll end up trying to give to our child in excess what we lacked in childhood. And I think that piece, that idea, that's where your work comes in. So, as is my directive or my answer to virtually all the questions that I get asked these days, or for many years, that is, it's that's why it's so important to do your own work. You know, to unravel your own trauma, to educate yourselves about how your own mental health impacts your child, to learn about your child's mental health, and what that asks or requires of you. And I don't know that we would be able to focus enough before things started to become a problem. I don't want to paint this with a Pollyannish brush, right? I don't want to whitewash the question, because there's deep and profound and real and chronic pain that exists in our lives. But, you know, my thought is, in part, that the children are here to teach us. And the more healing that we can do around our own work, not parenting our children, that comes out of our healed, our better selves, our highest self. The more we can heal our own work, the more we can change the trajectory of that intergenerational trauma, that intergenerational healing and growth. And so that our children will be just a little bit better than us. And then going into the next generation, I think the same thing will tend to occur over and over again, is that we'll get better and better. So I don't know that we could have focused on what we needed to learn before the problem came to be. We're always going to learn as we grow older and have more experiences. And it's really, really critical that we focus on healing our own trauma. I was talking to a client not too long ago where, in a business context, we were describing that idea that sitting around a boardroom table, that everybody's trauma is masked by agenda items for the meeting, right? People's opinions, ideas, and input, their complaints, their suggestions, their resolutions, all of those get mixed in with each person's trauma. And so often what we're dealing with is people's unhealed, undealt with, unexplored trauma. So again, purposely becoming a broken record, go back and do your work, go back and do your work. And the skill sets will come out of that and we'll get better and better. And, you know, it's a hard thing to learn. But what I do think is that as you heal and establish the model, you'll have that impact on your children. And then they will then have that impact on their children. Let me say this last point. When I have been asked to speak to new parents, first of all, new parents don't want to talk to me. Even colleagues, professional colleagues who respect my work, who are new parents, never ask me even one question about parenting. Because it's so simple at that point to them. And there's that old adage of, you know, there is such a thing as a perfect parent. They just haven't had any children yet. That still, when you have that newborn child, you still hold on to some of that fantasy that when it gets complicated, but you know, when we get them on a sleep schedule, when we're able to recognize the different kinds of cries for either a wet diaper or they're hungry or they're tired, after we get past that, we'll be able to figure out the more complicated questions, we think, by just intuiting it, by just using our common sense and from having learned from our parents' mistakes. And as you all know, it is tremendously more complex than that. And so in that way, our children become our teachers. I wrote something last year sometime, maybe it was longer than a year ago, with the pandemic, as for all of you that my timelines get kind of skewed and messed up. Some time ago, I posted something on social media saying, you know, having kids is a horrible idea, but there's no other way to learn what it means to be a human being and to love. Same with marriage. You know, marriage is something that you will fail at and struggle with. The same thing with having children. There's nothing in your life that matters to you that you will fail at more than parenting. So part of my response to this question or this comment you all are hearing is to shift from what should be or what should have been to what is. It's the Buddhist idea of radical acceptance, that when we spend a lot of time and energy in the what should be, our anger, our suffering that comes from grasping for what didn't happen, that if we can embrace what is happening, that we realize, like the Buddhists teach, that feelings pass through us, that we pass through our feelings. And that if we pay attention more to what is than what should have been, we also have access to the wisdom, the treasure, the gold that those lessons have to offer us. I'm not saying, again, that it's Pollyannish. I'm not saying we should give any of these speeches to somebody who's suffering acutely. We should listen and empathize and humbly hold space for their unsolvable problems. But if we're talking about it in a larger context and in a grander scheme, this is what's supposed to happen. And we're all doing the best that we can and we can all do better, right? That's the dialectical that we learn to hold at the same time. I'm doing the best that I can and I can do better. And part of what my children and my suffering, my pain are here to do is to teach me about things that I didn't learn as a child, that my parents and the culture, the dominant culture of my upbringing didn't teach me. And when we shift our perspective to that, we change our relationship to pain. We change our relationship to our children's problems. Like I said in the Journey of the Heroic Parent, and that's what we're spending every other session now doing a review of that book. Like I said there, the question is never what should I do? but rather, who am I? Who is my child? And what's my relationship to them and their issues, their problems? It is in exploring those questions that we find all the answers. And then the what should I do question gets answered by what I want to do, what I will do, what I can do, what I'm willing to do, what I'm not willing to do. I wrote this last week on my social media. I said, in our healing, should is replaced with will and will not, or can and cannot. That is, we stop thinking in terms of shoulds. Not because we should stop thinking of shoulds, but because we just do. And that's what I think one of the differences between Evoke's curriculum and a lot of mental health programming is, yes, we'll give you tools. Yes, we'll give you insights. Yes, we'll give you recommendations, but more fundamentally, our work is the same work that it is with your children, which is an invitation to a transformation, a higher level of consciousness. Like Einstein said, we cannot solve a problem at the same level of consciousness in which it was created. In other words, there is no answer to the question of what should I do that will make sense. Somebody said to me not too long ago that somebody gave them some advice that had the word should in it. And they said, I was struggling because on one level, the should didn't make sense to me. On another level, the advice that they were giving me made sense. And what I loved about this self-report of this relationship with a mentor that this person was sharing with me is they understood that there was still something missing in their mentor's dialogue and their mentor's understanding. Because they came in with a should, they were still missing something very important. They could have followed the 8 tips or tools. We have a podcast on that and a chapter in my new book on that. They could have been following the 8 tools for transforming relationships and said it more like, you might try this, or this might be helpful, or this is what has worked for me. I don't know if it will work for you. All of those phrases demonstrate an evidence that the person has an understanding of the basic relationship that they have with somebody else. But now I'm just pontificating too much, so I'll go to the next question. Somebody writes, our 14-year-old just left Evoke to a therapeutic boarding school. He is addicted to rap music. We only allow the clean version, but I've recently decided to vet the artists that are appropriate. Do you think this will make him want it much more? Is that too strict? You know, with these kinds of questions, it's a two-parter, at least, right? The first is, I have made it my goal to never tell parents where they should draw the line with their values and boundaries. That's the first part. The second part is a lot longer and a lot larger. And so what I'm saying with this first part is, I can't tell you. And yes, it could have the impact of pushing him towards, against your boundaries to develop a sense of self. That's in part what teenagers do. But I will tell you my own take on it, which is, it's not the symptom. In this case, it's not the rap music. You know, virtually every generation has listened to a music, listened to lyrical content that their parents don't like. Virtually every generation. I remember vividly my mother telling me, because this was long before my time, that her mother thought that Elvis Presley was from the devil. And my grandmother was fairly liberal. Not religious at all. I think she was an atheist. Pretty secular. But still had some conservative values and was sure that Elvis was going to be the downfall of the next generation. And was sure that he came from the devil or some agenda that was there to ruin children. And I thought about that. You know, when I was a little kid, I liked the band Kiss. And then I liked punk rock. And then I liked heavy metal, and now I like rap and everything involved. And my oldest son, who's 28 now, he went through a really serious rap phase. He was my firstborn, and so I was pretty alarmed, as you are, about the messages in it. And now I have a 13-year-old. I had two in between. Everybody finds a kind of music that helps give them a sense of power over their parents. You know, rap music and the themes in rap music are wonderfully tailored to children who feel powerless because it comes from a culture that has been oppressed systemically over hundreds of years and is finally lashing out at authority figures, violating social rules and norms, offending the dominant culture. And so, you know, I was just thinking about this just yesterday when with my 13-year-old, where she was listening to some music. And I was remembering back to my 28-year-old when he was about her age. In fact, we talked about this for a little bit, my daughter and I, my young one. My inclination is to invite you to understand why they're listening to it, to listen to the violence and the misogyny, the aggression toward authority and police, whatever it is, and to understand what is it in there that attracts them. Find what the symptom is trying to tell you. I used to say years ago that rap music is the equivalent of a Tyrannosaurus Rex. You know, little kids love dinosaurs. When I was a kid, it was T-Rex. I think now it's velociraptors and others that our science has shown to be maybe more prolific in their hunting. But at any rate, T-Rex. I didn't know why I liked T-Rex, but I love T-Rex. I love to play T-Rex. I love to have T-Rex, you know, action figures in my play set. I mean, think about that. As a 5-year-old, I identified with the most ferocious predator, or at least one of them, that ever walked on planet Earth. Why would a 5-year-old be specifically attracted to that? And I'm not alone in my admiration for T-Rex. T-Rex is a favorite of young children, predators, sharks. And I used to teach rap music is like a T-Rex. It's a child who feels powerless, hopeless, small, identifying with something that is angry and ferocious and large. So you can set your boundaries where you want. I can't dictate that. Your value system is yours, and it's not my job or any therapist's job to tell you where you should draw the line in your family, because that's up to you. But what I will tell you from a therapist's viewpoint is, try to understand why they like it. And it will lose some of its charge for you and for them. I know my son now, who is 28 years old, who doesn't listen to that kind of music anymore. We talk about those formative years when he was identifying with Lil Wayne at the time, was one of his favorite artists. And we talk about sometimes he feels embarrassed about liking it. Sometimes he leans in to understand what it gave to him. We talk about my fears about the messages that it was sending and so forth. But I think underneath and beside all of that, we, like I teach, have worked on ourselves and our relationship so much that we were able to, I think, transcend the symptom, to get beyond it, to hear and understand each other, where the symptom or the symbols and the symptom lost their charge, lost in some ways their effect, and we were just able to understand it. And he grew out of it, and he's become, you know, everything you would want a child to be. Happy, kind, generous, patient, loving, academically and professionally successful, and so forth and so on. So that's my long, long speech for probably a really simple answer, really simple question that you asked. Somebody asked the question, will you please speak to reconciling the idea of wholeheartedly accepting your horrible self while still striving to grow into a better version of yourself? It's kind of like that dialectical that I shared earlier, which is I'm doing the best that I can and I can do better. It's a popular dialectical that I didn't come up with, that somebody, many people have shared with me over the years. How do you reconcile? Because you do it from a different place. See, if you're operating in the worlds of shoulds, you're doing it to protect your ego, to be good. So it's not about what you do, it's where it comes from. Moral development, the final stages of moral development don't have shoulds in them. Don't sound like a talk from the pulpit, if you will. The most advanced stages of morality come from love. And so if I'm trying to be good, then my behaviors and actions and interactions are serving to protect that idea in myself. And I'm going to be defensive. I'm going to be less open to growth. I'm going to be slower to admit mistakes and apologize. I'm going to organize my defenses in a way to protect the idea that I need to be good. In other words, I don't accept or embrace my horrible, rotten self. In fact, I've evolved or grown above or beyond it. And what's worse about that side of the equation is that if I need to be good, then when I'm interacting with my children or my wife, I'm going to gaslight them. I'm going to explain why they misunderstood me. I'm going to explain my intention. I'm going to explain what I was meaning, where I was coming from. I'm going to need to tell a story, and I'm going to need to sell it to them and have them buy a story where I am good. Now, that's one side of the equation, and I hope all of you can recognize that behavior and intent in yourselves and recognize what it feels like to be in relationship to somebody who's acting from that place. Then you take it to the more humble place. The Dalai Lamas, the Gandhis. And I'm not putting these people up as gods or perfect. I'm just talking about appealing to some kind of idea. Mother Teresa, Martin Luther King Jr., Maya Angelou, just whoever your hero is. When you look at those folks, they are not only capable, but it's very common for them to talk about what scoundrels they are. That's a word that Gandhi used specifically to describe himself when he said, "I haven't done a very good job in self-control, which is why I have so much patience for all the other scoundrels in the world." Right? The enlightened ones realize that they're not good only, that they're whole beings, which involves being imperfect and selfish, if you use that word, and bad. They don't bifurcate the world into good and evil. They see wholeness and they strive for wholeness. And when you operate from that place of self-love and love toward others, you can apologize. You can admit mistakes. You can learn and grow. Because to learn and grow, you have to have not known something. You have to be ignorant. You have to be incomplete. And so accepting that you're a horrible, rotten self, which is really just saying you're a person, by the way. That's all I'm saying, is that you're a flawed, imperfect human. Maybe that helps. If you accept your own humanity, then you have patience and love for all the other humanity, and you're able to connect at that level. If goodness is the goal, then it's a very protected, right? Defended place to live. So the whole person can love more easily. The good person is virtually incapable of love because the primary goal is to defend the ego against being bad, against the horrible, rotten self. And if you don't accept your horrible, rotten self, your children will have to organize their defenses to protect you. And many of them won't have it and will develop symptoms. I read a book today. I was reading a book today that said that if our conscious mind, if we don't listen to our conscious mind, the unconscious mind will take care of it. If we don't learn to say no, if we don't learn to set boundaries, if we don't learn to ask for what we need consciously, then the unconscious mind will do the work for us. It's a powerful, powerful thing. Somebody writes, since I am not supposed to give my child advice, how do I go about giving my child suggestions for the next steps for school when he gets out of Evoke without it sounding like advice? I hope you'll tolerate my nitpickiness. Okay. Because I'm going to be a little bit nitpicky about this. First of all, it's not a supposed to. It's not that you should not give your child advice, because that's part and parcel of the same problem, right? It's just that it doesn't work as effectively. And the research is replete, exhaustive in this area. The book to read is it's not a very interesting dynamic book to read if you're just a layperson just curious about the principle. I did a podcast on it. The name of the book by Miller and Rolnick is called Motivational Interviewing. And the research is, even since the first edition that I read many years ago, and I have the newest edition, it has pages and pages and pages of resources that show that to confront and to be directive are less effective. So the way you do it is the way that I described a few moments ago, is you say, here are my thoughts. This is my idea. I have a thought. I have an idea. This has worked for me. This is how I've looked at similar situations. You might consider this. This might work for you. It's the 8 tools, right? My therapist, 22 years, hasn't given me advice. But she has said scores of times, you might try this, or you might consider this, or here's my thinking on the matter, or here's what's worked for me. There's less of an intrusion, especially when it's to a child, but it's similar to a therapist, to a client. It's intrusive to get inside of their circle, as we say at Evoke, or their sovereign sense of self, and to tell them how they ought to behave, how they ought to choose, how they should think. It strikes at something that is primitive in us that needs to maintain a separate sense of self. So you're fighting, you're at odds with the goal in development. I had a staff member who brought up in a training, we do a training each week with our staff, and I had a staff member who brought up in a training a few months ago, we were talking about manipulation. He said, but I'm a good manipulator. I get the kids to do the right thing, the good thing with my manipulation. So where's the harm in that? And my response was, well, that's not our goal. I mean, if that was our goal, then maybe there's no harm in that, or the harm is justifiable. But our goal is to raise a healthy self. And to raise a healthy self, if we manipulate children, we are creating a dependency on them for somebody outside of them to tell them what to do. And we create a kind of a vulnerability in them to bad actors, to unhealthy relationships, to others with mental illnesses. So they go out into the world and they get themselves in the most horrible of situations and relationships. And we, in part, are a part of that because we treated them like they were objects. We told them what to do. We told them how to behave. So it's not that you can't offer wisdom. It's just a different relationship with the other person that is best explained by phrases like, here's a thought, here's an idea, this is what I've done, you might think of this, maybe you could try this, what if this? If I was helping somebody make a decision about a school, I would ask them questions. And then I would challenge their thinking if I thought something in their thinking. It's like when a father said, well, I want to take my son home because I don't want him to think that we don't love him. And my response is, I don't know that that will work. I think what it will do is it will let him know that if you don't do what he says, then he'll accuse you of not loving him and you'll be held hostage by that. I think the only thing you can do to contribute to your child's sense that you love him is to love him. But you can't control how he feels. And if you get into that business of trying to control how your children feel, you got yourself a little bit of a problem. Because then you're part of the dynamic that creates the mental health issue in the first place. So you can talk with somebody. I wouldn't lay it all out there that fast, but we would get to that place, right? In regards to family therapy, what are the high level goals? When one parent is mentally ill and the therapy just doesn't click, their behavior negatively impacting their 16-year-old. Home therapist of other parent does not recommend family therapy due to mental illness. Mentally ill parents' behavior displayed in earlier attempts of family therapy. What kind of goals do we set here to help the 16-year-old, to help the family? What do we hope to accomplish in family therapy when mending the relationship might mean not having one? Well, you can have any goal that you want. You know, you can go in there. I mean, if you came to me, I would just help you to work on you. I would help you to learn how to cope when you have a co-parent that's mentally ill. You know, that's what Al-Anon or Codependence Anonymous or Families Anonymous can help you with, is what do you do when somebody in your family circle is mentally ill, has self-sabotaging, unhealthy behaviors that you can't stop? See, the issue is we want to control and fix that person because, well, that would make things a lot better for everybody. It's not even arguable. But what do you do when you can't do that? How do you deal with having a mentally ill co-parent or a mentally ill child or a mentally ill spouse or a mentally ill parent or a mentally ill friend or sibling? How do you cope? How do you deal? So you really do learn about what it means to be a human and what your relationship, your obligations are and aren't to other people. You learn about boundaries. You learn about your trauma that probably contributed to you picking a partner with a certain kind of mental illness. I say this all the time. It's interesting to me when somebody says, my ex-husband is a narcissist, or my ex-wife is a borderline. I think that's interesting. But what's fascinating, truly fascinating to me, is why did you choose them? And most people think, well, they weren't that way when I met them. And my response is, yeah, they were. It might not have been on full display like it eventually became, but it was there. I was just doing some training today explaining that most people can't see mental health and illness because we weren't taught it, because our parents struggled with mental illness, all of them. And the way that they treated us was in part mentally healthy and in part mentally ill. And we didn't know which was which. Things that we were told were loving and caring, good parenting, weren't. Because mental health and mental illness is a continuum that we are all on. Nobody is perfectly mentally ill, and nobody is perfectly mentally healthy. So what will happen in family therapy is you'll be directed to focus on those things within your control and to develop coping skills to deal with things outside of your control and to remain clear and steadfast at determining which is which and what to do about it. Having a mentally ill partner, ex-partner, co-parent is one of the greatest challenges in this work, of all the work that I do. People ask that question of me all the time, and I say it's my least favorite question, because no matter how hard you try, you're going to be fighting a fight with one hand tied behind your back. You can win a fight with one hand tied behind your back, but it's going to be tough and you're going to take some punches and you need support. So those are my thoughts. Somebody writes, I understand that we need to let go of the idea. Again, I'm going to stop and be a little bit nitpicky. I apologize. Remember, when you're asking your questions, I don't speak in terms of need to, have to, must, ought to, should, shouldn't, right, wrong, good or bad. So it's not a need to thing. You can or you can't. And anyway, I understand that we need to let go of the idea that we want what we want our child to be. This week, my 13-year-old qualified for state championship in a certain sport. He decided he didn't want to go for multiple reasons. One of them, I assume, is anxiety, that he will not perform. So it was easier for him not to go at all than not to go and not meet his expectations. We supported him and encouraged him to be true to himself, but I was left thinking that we have missed an opportunity to educate him about sticking with a goal, dream he worked hard towards or for in the face of his fears. I guess my dilemma is support him to face his fears, like in wilderness, or support him to be who he wants to be and let him miss an opportunity, even if it's scary. And parenting is hard, isn't it? You know what I would, in fact, Malia, what you could pull up if you want to, is the link to the blog that Keisha wrote recently, because I think it speaks to this. I think it's a great blog. Keisha is one of our admissions counselors, and I was so happy. I was proud of our company, because it wasn't a therapist writing this insightful blog. It was an admissions counselor. And to watch our non-therapeutic staff explore such amazingly complex, difficult, subtle human issues was just so, so powerful. So thank you for sharing the link right there. I don't know. It's just hard to know what to do. You just kind of wade your way through it and do the best you can. And you're right, there's lessons and wisdom in both sides. So much of my work has been to treat young people whose academic and sports and art success was prioritized over their mental health. So I have kind of a bias that those things are ancillary or secondary. You know, we all can think of examples of some of the most talented people in the history of humankind who were extraordinarily talented and exceptional in one area or another, sport or art or academics or science or whatever it is, who were out of balance. In the movie Good Will Hunting is a great example of that. I think the best way that you teach your child is to be as real and humble and not knowing and courageous as you can. I think they learn about doing difficult things by you doing difficult things. I think they learn about failure by you being willing to fail in the service of being your authentic self. I think they learn that success is not the penultimate achievement of humankind when you show up being your horrible, rotten self, apologizing, when you lean into failures and mistakes, when you become as curious about detours and mistakes as you are excited about successes. And it's a really, really, really hard thing that I have not totally succeeded at as a father. It's still a work in progress for me and will be until the day that I, till my last breath on earth. So I don't have a clear answer to the question, but it's a human question, and I don't know, and nobody else does, and it's really personal to you and to your child, and you might get it wrong, whatever that means. I've told you all that I have two children that are 25 and 28 and two children that are 18 and 13, so there was a space in between. I didn't make the same kinds of mistakes with my first two that I did with my second two. I found a whole new genre of mistakes to make with my second two. So somebody writes, I enjoyed the interview with Meredith. You mentioned she wrote about her parenting journey. Can you share a link, please? She's written about it on private chats and on Facebook. I don't have access to anything public. You're welcome to write a question or an email to webinar@evoketherapy.com, and I'll be happy to pass it on to her and to have her. In fact, she asked me to share any comments or questions that came up from her podcast interview. So I'll pass on anything through through us to her that you want me to pass on. Somebody writes, hi, my 16-year-old son had an incredible experience at Evoke and left on a high. He's in an aftercare boarding school, and after the initial step backwards where he got angry and upset with us sending him there, he has become more accepting, and we had a great second visit with him. He's allowed to call 3 times a week, and it seems to be a struggle for him, and he says he has nothing to say after the initial minutes. This week, he didn't call at all. He did send a few one-sentence email updates. We don't have a Zoom therapy once a week with him. We do have a Zoom therapy once a week with him. I am happy when he calls, and I try to let him go when he doesn't, even though I miss him. How do I approach this? It sounds like you're doing great. I think I'm glad that he has the right to do it 3 times a week, but he probably doesn't want to call and give you an update on his goings on. You know, adolescence is a time for individuation. So my thought is, you don't have to do this, but my thought is tell him to call within the constraints of his program. Tell him to call when he wants to and not call when he doesn't. And you'll send cards or letters or emails when you want to. This is normal type of individuation stuff. I feel the way about your son calling 3 times a week that I feel about Valentine's Day, frankly, or Mother's Day or Father's Day. It's this contrived moment when we're supposed to feel and think a certain way and then perform it. And life is more, it's just more mundane than that. I'd rather get a letter from one of my children, not on Father's Day by far, than on Father's Day. I'd rather get a note from my wife sometime during the year, much more so than on Valentine's Day. Luckily, my family feel the same way about these things for the most part. So, all right, I'm going to go to upcoming events and then we can see if there are any more questions that have been entered in.
Do you have a child who struggles with trauma, depression, anxiety, defiance, or substance abuse? Evoke Therapy Programs offers hope in the wilderness for teens and young adults ages 13 to 28.
Evoke uses humanity's inherent connection to the outdoors to facilitate lasting change. What can be accomplished in wilderness therapy simply can't be accomplished in a therapist's office or a hospital setting.
The outdoors and the challenges associated with living there bring teens and young adults to a better understanding of themselves, their true nature, and the importance of their relationships. To learn more, call me, Steve.
Or me, Keisha.
At 866-411-6600.
Find hope and healing today.
My two books, The Journey of the Heroic Parent and The Audacity to Be You, are on Amazon. Also, the audiobook is out now on The Audacity to Be You. I recorded it per your requests. If you want to do a deep dive into your own work, we encourage you. I love talking about this because I do it. I believe in it. My family does it. My managers do it. Our therapists do it. They do their own work. A deep dive into your own work. The next in-person intensive available is April 28th through May 2nd. 4.5 days in Northern Utah, in the Northern Utah area. If you want an online one that gives you a really great start into your own work, it's half the time, half the cost. April 21st through 23rd is available. And then if you're an alumni of our Finding You program, we have an in-person Finding You 2, which is the sequel, May 12th to 16th. Email intensives at evoketherapy.com for more information. Our admissions folks will be happy to talk to you about what's a good fit for you. It's a great springboard into your work, or I like to think of it as a therapy accelerator for those of you who have done a significant amount of work. We have pursuits, adventure trips for adults and families. It can be used between programs. These trips are customized anywhere between 3 days to 30 days, can involve any kinds of activities, any conglomeration of parents and children. If the children are younger, it's going to be more experiential and activity-based. If they are older, there'll be a lot more therapy involved in it, but it'll be at your request. We have support groups online for Wilderness current parents and alumni and intensives alumni. So our next one for Wilderness parents is April 1st. That's this week at 6:30 p.m. Mountain Time. And then our intensives program. Did we change that, Malia? We might have changed that April 1st meeting because I'm doing the special webinar. She'll tell me in a minute. April 8th is the next one after that, 6:30 p.m. And if you're an intensives alumni, April 13th at 6 p.m. Mountain Time. You can email malia@evoketherapy.com for more information or to sign up there. We ask all current parents to go to a 12-step support group, 6 of them while your child is with us. Any combination of Al-Anon, CODA, Families Anonymous, or adultchildren.org. You can also try out Refuge Recovery. Go to refugerecovery.org. Or the National Alliance on Mental Illness offers classes and resources in your local area, in your local chapter. All of these broadcasts are available on your favorite podcast app. Just search Finding You, an Evoke Therapy podcast, or go to soundcloud.com and search the same thing. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram using the handle @EvokeTherapy, or on Instagram, you can also find @EvokeTherapyIntensives. On Facebook, you can find us by searching Evoke Therapy Programs or Evoke Therapy Intensives. And also our blog has wonderful, great content each week. No more questions. All right, folks, thank you for joining me this evening. I hope this is a helpful point of contact. I hope more than anything, you kind of hear about an invitation into a different level of consciousness, a different kind of sensibility, a transformation, a new way of thinking. That's what I hope. That's what I try to present. Thank you for joining me this evening. Thank you for and on behalf of the people that you love, your children especially, for doing your work and tuning in. Take care. Have a great week, and I'll talk to you on Thursday evening. Bye-bye. Bye.